Hello, listeners. We just want to give a brief content warning for our episode. We're going to be discussing topics that you might find disturbing, including the murder of women and children and suicide. So please use caution when listening.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymee Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, coercive control and family annihilation. Hello, and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Tymee.
Happy 2025.
Yeah, we were just talking, it's our first recording of the new year,
yes.
Although it is February.
It is February. We're a little rusty, but because of our recording schedule, we're ahead.
Yeah, we've got plenty banked.
Yeah, listeners won't know. This will come out in March, and you know, it will be just like, yeah.
Yeah.
So this semester, I'm teaching my mass in serial murder class.
Nice.
And this actually came from a previous semester, but we discussed different categories of mass killers. And the one we'll be talking about today is called Family Annihilator, but there's also something called the Workplace Avenger. And a previous student had pointed out that these sounded like superhero names. So what do you think of that assessment?
Yeah, I can see that. I would say like the Avenger aspect kind of makes it sound like the Avengers, but Annihilator sounds more like a supervillain to me, like the Annihilator of the family.
It's somewhat, it's somewhat sensational though, I think. If you can, like when you can make that noise, right, and say it sounds like a superhero name, it's maybe a little bit sensational.
Like, or the Terminator, Terminator, the family Terminator.
This is why we have a content trigger warning at the beginning, because we make light of these very serious topics because we have to.
Well, laugh or cry, and I choose laugh.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do we know about family annihilation? Are all of these guys mass murderers?
Yeah, so listeners should go back to our episodes on mass murder for a refresher. But researchers use four or more victims in one event as a guideline to consistently measure mass murder. So if the perpetrator kills only three family members, then it would not be counted as a mass murder, but it is still a type of family annihilation.
Yeah. I mean, it's like three or four.
Right. Yeah. So family annihilation is a type of intrafamilial homicide, which could include the killing of parents, siblings, cousins, etc. And Park Dietz, who's a forensic psychiatrist, coined the term in the 1980s. It is more common to use familicide or intrafamilial homicide now when referring to these cases.
Have you watched Penguin?
No.
On HBO Max?
I haven't yet.
Do you plan to watch that?
Yes.
Okay, then.
Don't spoil it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, don't spoil for our listeners either.
Well, I was going to give a spoiler warning anyway. But anyway.
Yeah.
There's a
Family Annihilator?
Familicide in that show.
Okay.
So far, it's like the best scene in the whole show so far.
Okay. Well,
but no spoilers. I won't give you any hints.
But
or
definitely, you're giving us a rack for Penguin. Is that what you're saying? Like we should watch it?
Yeah, it's actually good.
Okay.
So I was
I'll add it to the queue.
I was totally against it from the beginning. Like I'm just so sick of Batman shows with no Batman.
Yeah.
And there's like 20 of them at this point.
Yeah.
But then I started hearing really good things about this show.
Okay.
And it's on Max. And I checked it out. And it actually is. I've still got three or four more episodes to go, but it's good.
Okay.
I would recommend it.
Okay. I'll add that to my very long queue of things I need to watch.
Yeah. And keep your eyes peeled for some good old familicide.
Let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have no repository dedicated solely to cases of family annihilation, but researchers look at individuals who kill two or more immediate family members in one event. So again, the definition, if it meets mass murders based on the victims. So using this definition, IndyStar examined thousands of homicides, including 227 cases of family annihilation from the years 2020 to 2023. And spoiler alert, or not so surprising maybe is what I should say, men are almost always the perpetrators.
Yeah, definitely as criminologists, this is not a shock at all.
Yes, it's a common common theme. So there's three other things that they sort of pulled out as being common in terms of these scenarios. One is men who killed their wives or girlfriends and children. The second was the categories of young men who killed their parents and siblings. Mm-hmm. And the third category are couples who conspired to kill their children and themselves. Mm. So it also found primary risk factors, probably not surprising, mm-hmm. include prior domestic violence, substance abuse, and access to guns. Mm-hmm. A gun was used in about 86% of cases. However, other methods, including stabbing, strangulation, blunt force trauma, asphyxiation, and arson were also used. Mm. In terms of, you know, where are most of these occurring, mm-hmm. more than three quarters of the cases occurred in the South and the Midwest. Texas had the most, followed by Florida, Arizona, and Ohio. Only 10 states and D.C. had no cases of family annihilation.
Interesting.
Yes, and unlike the larger category of mass murder, family annihilators killed themselves in only 64% of cases. Now, that's still over mm-hmm. half and majority, but that number is much higher for mass mm-hmm. murderers.
Really?
Yes.
I would have thought the opposite, like family annihilators would be more likely to kill themselves than the generic mass murder.
Yeah, you would think that. But when you separate it out by category, it mm-hmm. gets a little bit more complicated. So I feel like the best strategy for us to talk about that mm-hmm. is to break up these categories, because we mm-hmm. introduced mass murder mm-hmm. as a topic, but we didn't really talk specifically about the different types. This is kind mm-hmm. of our first episode
gotcha.
That gets into mm-hmm. that nuance. Mm-hmm.
So what else do these men have in common?
Familicide perpetrators share many common characteristics with perpetrators of domestic violence. Both may be likely to dominate the relationship, feel the need to maintain control, abuse substances such as drugs and alcohol, and have a patriarchal perspective of the family unit. Mm-hmm. So most of the men who have committed familicide were also found to have had some combination of prior exposure to abandonment, rejection, abuse, and violence in their childhood years, which may have resulted in poor coping skill development. Mm-hmm. So there's also a higher chance of familicide when the at-risk partner attempts to leave or has left the relationship. Yeah. This is one of the greatest risk factors and well-documented. Mm-hmm. This attempt to end the relationship may create suspicions of infidelity and feelings of sexual jealousy and cause the perpetrator to feel challenged regarding patriarchal possession of the family.
Yeah, you've mentioned this patriarchal thing a couple of times.
Right.
And I think that that kind of ties back to what you said about like the South and the Midwest yes. is so much higher in terms of familicide. But if you yeah. think about like the predictors like violence and drugs and poverty and alcohol abuse and particularly patriarchal
yes.
norms, I think that makes sense why sure. the South and Midwest would be particularly high in terms of familicide.
Absolutely. You see that cluster of social problems there. Mm-hmm. So access to firearms specifically increases the level of danger, as most familicides are committed with a gun. So threats to harm oneself or kill oneself or others also may be a predictive indicator of familicide, which is mm-hmm. why the at-risk partner is often asked whether the perpetrator has threatened or attempted suicide. Mm. Threats of homicide or suicide may be the perpetrator's way of preparing for action and squelching any residual feelings of ambivalence. Hmm. So it's preparation, really. Mm-hmm. Perpetrators with narcissistic traits.
Preparation H. Homicide. Sorry, that just came to me.
I bet, yeah, our students wouldn't even know what preparation H is because they don't see those commercials anymore.
No commercials anymore.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So perpetrators with narcissistic traits are more likely to survive the act as they choose not to die by suicide. One of the reasons that I'm discussing family annihilation with coercive control is that it is a risk factor for homicide, even in the absence mm-hmm. of any physical violence.
Yeah, so explain that. How is coercive control related to homicide and intrafamilial violence?
In some cases of family annihilation, there were previous documented threats to self and others, like I said. Protective orders are also no guarantee of safety, as some people are killed, some women and children are killed while under a protective order.
Yeah.
What tends to confuse the public about this issue is the man with no documented history of physical violence to his family suddenly killing them all.
Yeah.
When you look at the details of many of these cases, coercive control is present, although not recognized as a risk factor since it might not be violent. So, for example, the Mumper case profiled by the Indy Star investigation in the report was about the September 2020 murder of a wife and two children by their 61-year-old husband and father, who then killed himself. The wife, Greta, had previously described him to friends as somewhat of a selfish person, kind of passive-aggressive, and a basically unsupportive husband who was facing a late-stage cancer diagnosis. And he had been emotionally abusive at times during their marriage. She was unhappy, and she wanted to leave for like a decade prior. She was planning on divorce before the cancer diagnosis, and he may have been harboring an aggrievement for that. So he was suicidal, given the diagnosis, but he wanted to take his family with him. And there had been no physical violence in their relationship at all.
No physical violence. I mean, it's understandable why he would, well, I mean, not, maybe not understandable, but like you can see why he would want to kill his wife there.
Yes.
But what about the kids? Why kill the kids?
Right. So children are, in most cases, not the targeted victims. They're killed as part of ending the whole family unit or as extensions of the targeted partner due to the perpetrator's inability to see individuation in the family
like
members.
Like, this is my unit.
This is my, you possess this.
It's one thing and it's mine.
Right. Gotcha. These are my kids. Anomic familicide is rare and does not include the same predictive factors mentioned earlier. It occurs even in the absence of a previous history of domestic violence or the threat of a partner leaving. This happens after a drastic and sudden change or loss that negatively and significantly impacts the ability of the family to sustain their current quality of living.
So when you say anomic familicide, the, this situation is would be an example of that. Like the cancer diagnosis is the big thing that changed the family dynamic, that
and
loss
again,
or sudden change.
Right.
And the familicide is a kind of a reaction or response to that.
Yes. And the kids are not the targets. They're, again, part of the family unit. And the individual thinks that they possess them.
Gotcha.
So such impacts and the loss of control may leave the main family provider feeling panicked and desperate, although desperation is commonly blamed on their economic conditions. It's actually the stress created because of the drastic economic change that leads to this sense of desperation.
Gotcha. So back to coercive control. What is that specifically?
So coercive control is defined as or refers to a systematic pattern of behavior that establishes dominance over another person through intimidation, isolation, and terror-inducing violence or threats of violence. Doesn't always have to be a part, but sometimes just the threats or hints at it is enough, right?
Right.
So isolation is a big part of this, as the controlling partner restricts the freedom and independence of the controlled partner, isolating them from friends, family, or other support systems. They're also entrapped within the relationship due to financial, logistical, social, and emotional barriers to leaving. So coercive control can instill fear even in the absence of physical violence and can continue after the relationship ends. Research shows that coercive control is associated with elevated rates of psychological, physical, and sexual victimization, as well as lethal violence. So Evan Stark conceptualized the term coercive control after what he saw as the failure of domestic violence interventions in improving women's long-term safety in relationships or to holding perpetrators accountable. So he identified the problem as the singular focus on violence against women, which ignored the millions of abusive relationships where men used a largely unidentified form of subjugation that more closely resembled kidnapping or indentured servitude than assault. So he called this pattern coercive control, and it was based on a range, his research was based on a range of sources, including FBI statistics and his own experience and research as a forensic expert. So Stark showed how men can use coercive control to extend their dominance over time and through social space in ways that subvert women's autonomy, isolate them, and infiltrate the most intimate corners of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds bad. That sounds menacing. Like, usually when we think of abuse, we think of, like, physical violence.
Right.
Like, the man beating the woman.
Yes.
But abuse is so much more than that. And it can be, you know, this kind of like pattern. I'm thinking of like the podcast Dirty John. Like he was not physically abusive to her, And, you know, like she met this guy online and he was like super in love with her and they got married. But like very soon he was trying to like separate her from her daughters. He installed video cameras in the house, had GPS trackers on her car, like passwords to social media and all of this stuff. Right. So that's not physically abusive, but that's coercively controlling.
And some of it's hard to pinpoint, right? Mm-hmm. Because another thing that you can do is control finances. So you take away the woman's ability to pay for anything herself. And once you control finances, you control time, all of that stuff. Like, what are you going to do, right?
Isolate them from their family so you're their only means of survival or the only thing, the only place to turn to,
Right. And that link, again, between coercive control and family annihilation. So the coercive control model Start developed resolved three challenges he saw posed by abuse. Why these relationships endure, why abused women develop a profile of problems seen among no other group of assault victims, and why the legal system has failed to win them justice.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, like part of the process is to make the victim totally dependent on the abuser. You cut off all support, so you're the only source of that.
Yes.
Financial, house, money, basic living needs, emotional support.
Yes.
And then there's, you know, this like psychological, emotional, abusive aspect, like nobody loves you, I'm the only one that loves you, you're damaged goods, and I'm the only one that will ever appreciate you.
Yes. In many courts, coercive control is not recognized as abuse, even by judges who end up repeating rape myth arguments in sexual assault cases. The why did you stay or why did you keep going back? And they end up denying protection orders for this reason. One California investigation looking into this after the passing of a 2021 coercive control statute found little evidence that judges were trained in coercive control in order to apply the new statute. So in Scotland and the UK, coercive control is treated more seriously as abuse. And in 2018, Scotland made sure that judges knew how to apply it in cases by assigning money into the bill for judicial training before the law went into effect. So other countries have started to consider criminalizing non-physical violence as abuse.
Well, that's a good sign.
Yes.
But what about famous cases like Alex Murdaugh? We've talked about that several times. He killed his wife and son. Is he a family annihilator?
He is, but not a mass murderer since he did not kill four family members. It was just his wife and son. This case, of course, fascinated the public. There were multiple documentaries on competing networks, a docudrama released, and the murder trial was televised. So Murdaugh was an example of the anomic annihilator who was experiencing financial difficulties. So he did not kill them out of anger or revenge, but out of desperation due to his circumstances. He may have felt as though he were saving the family from the humiliation of uncovering the truth about his crimes and the end of their lifestyles as they knew them. But it's also possible he was trying to save Paul, which is a line of thinking, from the fallout over the boat crash that he was involved in that did kill someone. So he's an example of a self-preserving narcissist. And these family annihilators are less likely to die by suicide because he had that failed attempt of, like, he said somebody shot him, though. So there are some other cases that have received quite a bit of media attention in the U.S. and highlight some of the risk factors that we've discussed. In January 2023, a Utah husband murdered his wife, mother-in-law, and five children, ages 4 to 17, before dying by suicide. He had recently been investigated for child abuse by the Utah Division of Child and Family Services. His wife had filed for divorce. He had threatened suicide, right? So back to that, has the perpetrator... if she left him or was said he was going to make her life hell. So a very obvious risk factors here. They should have been protected. In the 2018 Watts case, Chris Watts, that also received a lot of media attention. I think one of my student groups this semester are doing their case project on this one. So he was a husband who strangled his wife, Shannon Watts, and then used the same blue blanket to smother their two daughters. He dumped the girls' bodies in oil barrels in a facility where he worked and buried their mother in a shallow grave nearby. After first claiming that Shannon and the girls had disappeared, he then said he had strangled Shannon after seeing her kill the daughters. He eventually confessed to murdering his whole family. telling police he had been having an affair with a coworker, and then told Shannon he didn't love her anymore. He said that she responded by saying, "You're never going to see the kids again," and he snapped and strangled her. So Watts pleaded guilty to murder in November 2018 in a deal with prosecutors to avoid the death penalty and was sentenced to 3 consecutive terms of life in prison.
Gotcha.
So how would you assess the differences in these two cases, given what we discussed?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like coercive control was maybe not a big factor in the Alex Murdaugh case. I don't recall ever hearing anything that he was, like, abusive or controlling of the family. It just seems like he was, like, a rich, entitled narcissist who didn't want his financial skullduggery to be exposed.
Correct.
But the Watts case seems more like coercive control might have been a thing. I didn't realize this until, like, you know, I was looking at the script, but I saw this documentary and I didn't remember like the Watts or what it was called, but the, like the bearing in the oil field, I do remember that. I don't remember like being like abusive overtly, being a history of abuse, but it does seem like he kind of killed his family to keep them from leaving him. So some of those ideas of like, you know, it's my family, family annihilation. And I think he even contemplated killing himself at one point or something.
Well, I mean, it's hard to believe anything he says.
Yeah, true.
It really is.
That's for sure. Yeah.
I think one of the reasons, you know, people bring this case up and they hate him so much is because he actually tried to blame the wife that he strangled for killing their daughters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
dirtbag. I mean, am I close? What do you think about
it? Yeah, so there was control in the relationship. There was no physical violence, and that's what confused people. And there have been several cases of a family annihilation where that was not present. And it's more like the example that I mentioned earlier, where maybe the wife had disclosed to family and friends that he was, you know, selfish or wanted to control her time or wouldn't let her go places or looked through her phone. Those are all, like, that's all evidence of coercive control.
Yeah.
And that is a risk factor for homicide, even without physical violence.
Gotcha.
And that's what gets lost in these conversations. So that's what Stark was trying to bring forward, is that these are obvious cases where we need to have, you know, protection in place also because of the risk of homicide.
Yeah, agreed. You got anything else?
I do not.
All right, then that means it's our Minute to Spin It, where we give our takeaway from the show today. So, Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
So, just to wrap it up, power and control are key to understanding coercive control and intrafamilial homicide. Having a partner who attempts to control or isolate you in any way should be considered a red flag and potentially life-threatening. Intervention should happen early.
Big time.
Love bombing at the beginning of a relationship should also be treated as a huge red flag. And in some cases, it's considered abuse. In almost all cases of family annihilation, unless it was an argument that escalated or was context specific, there were warning signs, even if no physical abuse is present. Ben, what's your spin?
Well, so you mentioned love bombing, and I don't think we talked about that or defined that, but what is that? I mean, I have a general idea of what that means, but what's a definition for that? What would that look like?
Yeah, so people who engage in coercive control usually always start with love bombing, and this is also a way to manipulate and control you. So you start off with a relationship by excessive flattery, excessive attention, sending lots of unwanted and unnecessary gifts. It's not your normal, you know, kind of dating, so I'm giving you small gifts. They're always excessive.
And like early attention, and quick, too.
Yes, early and quick. You know, saying I love you very quickly. So it's kind of a smothering, if you will. And it is a way to manipulate and control you because that's the first stage. After you're with the person, that completely changes, and that's when the coercive control starts to come in. But anybody, if you're dating someone, you know, like just giving somebody you just started dating a gift is not the same thing. You're basically, you're sensing that you're being overwhelmed and that should be a red flag. It can make you feel good. Like flattery feels nice. Excessive devotion feels nice. Getting all of this attention, sending you 1,000 text messages saying, I'm just thinking about you right now. All of that feels nice, but it's overwhelming you in a way that's manipulative. It's the beginning of the coercive control.
Yeah, it's like baiting or setting the hook. I mean,
yes.
You know, nobody's going to want to, you know, hitch their apple cart to somebody who is abusive and controlling and, you know, wants their to look through their phone immediately. And so you've got to kind of like almost trick them into it, like overly excessive love bombing and gifts. And you're so wonderful and you're so, you know, beautiful and you're the, you know, the only person for me. And then once you get that hook in, once they're attached, then you turn the switch and start doing all of this.
And they want to
controlling stuff.
Get the relationship official and set very quickly, right? Because they want to overwhelm you with all of this. Now you're in a position where, so that's love bombing. Don't get love bombed.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, for my spin, I don't have a song or anything funny or clever for this one, but I'll just say it is important to know more about coercive control and to be able to recognize the signs and protect yourself from falling in too deep with a control, a coercive controller. Beware the love bomb.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website, linked in show notes, to see how you can support our educational programming.